Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken meets Arab foreign ministers on Saturday.
He has a very tough mission right now. Yesterday, he was here in Israel. He was in Tel Aviv, had a meeting with Mr. Benjamin Netanyahu and asked once more for a ceasefire, humanitarian pause on this war.
Ghana's ruling party plans to select a presidential candidate on Saturday to lead the group in next year's general election.
We've been working very hard for the past 6 months or so, and that gives us the confidence based on the feedback from the surveys and research that we've made and other studies that have been made by even our competitors.
And the CEO of Ethiopia Airlines announces expansion plans as part of the group's strategic efforts. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa.
This year has been a very successful year for Ethiopian Airlines. We have expanded our network by increasing frequencies to the existing destinations and adding new destinations. In fact, we opened 7 new destinations in that fiscal year.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is in the Jordanian capital Amman, where he is meeting Arab foreign ministers. They are demanding an opening of a humanitarian corridor and an immediate ceasefire. The talks come a day after meeting Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. It forms part of the effort to find a solution to the ongoing conflict between Israel and Hamas. For the latest development in the ongoing Israeli-Hamas conflict, I reach reporter Yam Boshat in Eastern Jerusalem.
He has a very tough mission right now. Yesterday, he was here in Israel. He was in Tel Aviv, had a meeting with Mr. Benjamin Netanyahu and asked once more for a ceasefire, humanitarian pause on this war. And again, Mr. Netanyahu said, Israel will not stop the war, will not stop attacking Gaza until the more than 200 hostages abducted on the October 7th will be released.
Talk to me about the impact of the ground invasion in Gaza, because there are suggestions that the speech of the Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah was less aggressive than many had predicted. Talk to me about this.
There was a lot of fear and expectation that the ground invasion in Gaza would set fire in the whole region, in Lebanon, with Hezbollah here in the West Bank, with the Islamic Jihad fighters and other armed groups that favor a more confrontational approach to Israel, or even in Egypt, where the population was protesting against Israel, or in Turkey, where the President Erdogan made some very strong speech against Israel and also pro-Hamas. What we've seen the last week, and the ground invasion started almost a week ago, none of this happened. You know, the West Bank is tense. It's true. There's a lot of violence going on, but nothing different from the previous week.
On Friday, there was a convoy of ambulances leaving the Shifa hospital that was hit by an Israeli artillery. What is the current situation there?
The information are still coming up. The scenes, the videos that are coming from there are just terrible. You can see dozens of people dead, dozens of people injured, people that were already injured being attacked once more. The IDF, Israeli forces, said confirmed they attacked this convoy of ambulances, and according to them, inside the ambulances were some Hamas fighters or Hamas leaders that were trying to leave the northern part of the street to the southern part of the street. This information can't be independently verified so far, but the fact is dozens of people got killed in this attack. It was in front of Al-Shifa Hospital, the biggest hospital in Gaza, and especially in Gaza City.
You were in the West Bank yesterday. You spent a day there. What did you witness? What is the situation on the ground?
Violence is escalating in the West Bank, for sure. The UN said that this year is the deadliest year for the West Bank in the last 15 years. The day before, one Israeli Jewish settler was killed during, he was traveling in his car in the West Bank, and he was shot. Nobody claimed responsibility for this attack, but it's something that it's boiling up. You can see on the streets and talking to the people that the president of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, is losing power. It's losing the capability to be the leader of the West Bank, because people say, look, this guy has been trying to find a solution through dialogue for the last 30 years, and things are just getting worse.
Jan Borchardt is a VOA reporter. He spoke with me from Eastern Jerusalem in Israel. A former Egyptian assistant foreign minister for Arab affairs is calling for an immediate cessation of hostilities between Israel and Hamas. Ambassador Abdirahman Saleh al-Din says Egypt may not have what he says is the luxury of time, waiting until Israel defeats Hamas fighters and leaders and destroys their tunnels and equipment. This after expressing concern in an opinion piece about the ongoing conflict and what he says is the devastating impact, including death and destruction, on the unarmed civilians. For more on solutions to end the conflict, I reach Ambassador Saleh al-Din via Skype. He outlines solutions, the first step of which he says is a call for Egypt, in agreement with the international community, to begin by proposing that Israel and all Palestinian factions in Gaza agree to an immediate and comprehensive ceasefire and an agreed exchange of prisoners and hostages.
Because it would end the war. This war is not going to serve either side interests. It would cost thousands more of innocent Palestinians' lives. It would also extremely damage Israel's reputation on the international scene, and would harm the Israeli economy, because it's not going to finish in one day. So ending this war today, in the context of a package that would deliver security to Israel, and would deliver the promise of sovereignty and national independence for the Palestinians. That is the trade-off that I am envisaging in my proposal.
Now, you also talked about forming an international team of representatives of Arab and Western donors and concerned countries to supervise the reconstruction and rehabilitation of Gaza. What does that mean for this conflict?
It means what we always call international protection and international monitoring and administration. This international peacekeeping force would be composed of many elements. One element would take care of disarming Gaza, making sure that there is no arm left there that could threaten the security of Israel. At the same time, it would also supervise a buffer zone, a new expanded Gaza, by extending the borders of Gaza into the Israeli Negev.
Well, you also called for an international conference immediately after the ceasefire. What should contain in this conference, and what should be the outcome that will guarantee the protection or the security of Israel?
Actually, it provides equally assurances both sides, because in this international conference, I am suggesting that the United States would be present and would also participate in the international peacekeeping force, and all other members, permanent members of the Security Council, should also be present. There, I think if we are able to have the United Nations Security Council pass a resolution or a unanimous declaration that the Palestinian state is going to be established within 2 years through agreement by both sides, and that the Security Council would guarantee the security of both sides, and this newly established Palestinian state is going to be at the very beginning without any heavy weapons. It will only have the police armament.
Ambassador Abderrahman Salah El-Din is a former Egyptian assistant foreign minister for Arab Affairs. He spoke with me via Skype from the Egyptian capital, Cairo. Meanwhile, Americans for Peace Now's president and CEO Hadar Saskind has sent a letter to Secretary of State Antony Blinken and President Biden, urging the administration to push for a humanitarian pause in the Israel-Hamas war and to intensify its diplomatic efforts to protect the lives of Palestinian civilians impacted by the current crisis. Oriel Neer, spokesman for Americans for Peace Now, discussed the request for a humanitarian pause with VOA's senior analyst Mohamed El-Shinawi.
We're alarmed by the situation on the ground. We understand that the Israeli military effort is going to be protracted. It's going to be long. And we see that the number of civilian casualties in Gaza is rising. It's surging. It's over 9,000 people so far. This is a horrifying number. And we feel that there's an imperative here to minimize the level of death and destruction and suffering of Palestinian civilian population in Gaza. And therefore, we're trying to see what kind of things the United States administration can do in order to work with Israel to keep that to a minimum. And we're satisfied to see that Secretary Blinken, who just left Israel, in his discussions in Israel with Israeli leaders, brought up these concerns, and we're hoping that he was successful in it.
In addition, the letter calls for fuel to relief agencies in the Gaza Strip to be included in any humanitarian aid, and stated that without an adequate supply of fuel to UNRWA, the humanitarian assistance permitted to enter Gaza essentially becomes worthless, exacerbating the suffering of the already vulnerable population in Gaza. What can the U.S. do to ensure that?
Well, I have to say it's complicated. This really is a conundrum. Fuel is vital. It's necessary in order to make the humanitarian relief that is being sent into Gaza worth anything. In other words, in order to make it worth anything, you have to distribute it. And in order to distribute it, you have to fuel the trucks that carry it to the civilian population in Gaza. If the trucks don't have fuel, they can't deliver it. If the hospitals in Gaza don't have fuel, they can't treat the wounded. So fuel is necessary. We are aware, however, that Hamas is trying to steal that fuel from international relief organizations. And we know that this is not a perfect solution, but what we're suggesting is that UNRWA becomes the agency through which fuel will be delivered and distributed, and hoping very much that Hamas will not steal fuel from UNRWA. Even if it does, however, we still think that it's worthwhile to deliver the fuel, again, through UNRWA, in order to make the relief deliveries that are being sent to Gaza available for the people who need them.
So how would you follow up with the State Department on that?
Well, we'll see. We'll see what is being done. We are aware of the fact that the Israeli government is not willing to provide fuel and is saying that the condition for the provision of fuel is that Hamas release hostages. We understand it. We understand the sentiment. We still think that the provision of humanitarian relief, including fuel, should be unconditional, and we're going to continue working with our representatives in Congress and with our interlocutors in the Biden administration to try to put pressure on the Israeli government that such, is again, essential, vital humanitarian relief is being provided, including fuel.
Ori Ner is spokesman for Americans for Peace Now. He spoke with viewers Mohamed El Shinawi. In Guinea, the justice minister has announced a jailbreak involving the country's former military leader, Moussa Dadis Camara. Minister Charles Alphonse Wright says gunmen stormed the main prison and freed the former leader in the early hours in the capital, Conakry, Saturday. He also announced the closure of the country's borders following the jailbreak. Camara came to power in a military coup in 2008. He is detained for his alleged connection to a stadium massacre while in power. In Ghana, the governing New Patriotic Party, or NPP, is set to choose a presidential candidate on Saturday. The selected candidate will lead the party in next year's presidential contest. Incumbent Vice President Mohamedou Bawumia faces tough competition from three other contestants, including businessman and parliamentarian Kennedy Ejiofor. Analysts say campaigning for the party's nomination has been elevated as each of the contestants try to convince delegates to vote for them. For more on the ruling party's internal election, I reach Fred Owari. He is the campaign coordinator for Vice President Bawumia.
Well, we've worked very hard. We've been to every single constituency. I've gone around the country about three times on his behalf. And he's done that, not just touching base with the executives at the constituency level, but actually the polling station executives who form about 96% of the electoral college. He's spoken to each and every one of them. We've been calling them. We've been working very hard for the past 6 months or so, and that gives us the confidence based on the feedback from the surveys and research that we've made and other studies that have been made by even our competitors. We are on the conviction that we are winning, but we want to win with some very greedy numbers. You know, we want a high percentage so that we give a clear message to the whole country that the party is united behind one leader.
Well, Mr. Wari, I hear he faces a fierce competition from some of the contestants who are also equally campaigning and trying to win the support of delegates.
There's been a lot of noises surrounding the whole process. And so from the outside, you get the impression that the competition is fierce, but we don't see it that way. We do know that for the first time, we have a candidate who has touched the hearts of the grassroots as well as the top leaders of the party. And the evidence was in the first round of elections where we got almost 70% of the votes cast. And these were the leaders of the party at the regional constituency levels, the national, the diaspora, former officers, ministers, MPs. And that gives a clear indication to the rest of the party which way the party is going.
What are your expectations of unity after the elections? Because I understand there appears to be an agreement signed that all the losing candidates will support the nominee of the party because there are concerns of a possible split.
Well, we've conducted a very clean campaign. There's absolutely no record whatsoever that the main campaigner, as the vice president, has used any foul language against any other person. We've endured all the insults and the false accusations. We've despised the shame which go with some of these things, and we've kept our cool, making sure that we do not offend anybody. We believe that is the key to bringing everybody together, because when you've conducted your campaign with civility and decorum, it's easy for you to invite people to come and join. Additionally, what we've also done is in instances where the election committee even sought to change some rules that we consider to be unconstitutional as far as the party constitution is concerned, we, for the sake of peace and unity, we have quietly just agreed to that, just so the losing parties would understand that it was a clean and clear playing field, and therefore nobody is going to say that the election process itself was skewed to favor our candidate. And so these are some of the strategies and policies that we have ensured that post-elections, we should be the ones who should offer the olive branch to the losing parties, who would also by themselves will know that they lost in a fair competition. Once there's fairness and everybody admits that there's fairness, I think the losing parties won't have any problem. Once you're a member of the party and you have a lot of following, you might just be carried away and think that when you break away, you break away with the following. But the people are following you because you continue to be a member of the party. The moment you leave the party, you'll be surprised that all of them will decide to stay.
Fred Owari is the campaign coordinator for Ghana's Vice President Muhammadu Bawumia. He spoke with me from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. Rwanda says it will allow all Africans to travel visa-free to the country. President Paul Kagame made the announcement this week and highlighted the potential of Africa as a unified tourism destination for a continent which still relies on 60% of its tourists from other parts of the world. Other countries that allow Africans to enter without visas are Gambia, Benin, and Seychelles. Kenya's President William Ruto also announced Monday plans to allow all Africans to travel to the East African nation visa-free by December 31st. My colleague Douglas Impuga reached David Monda, a political analyst and professor of political science at City University of New York, and began by asking him what he thought of this move.
It has advantages. It's a good step in regards to elements of improving cross-border trade, elements of reducing non-tariff barriers in terms of just the hassle of individuals having to access other African countries. It enhances people-to-people networking. So those human-to-human contacts are also very important. But it also brings its own challenges. So when we're thinking about issues of national security around international terror network, questions around crime, drug, and human trafficking syndicates will be helped when it's easier to travel across and between borders. But you also have broader questions around challenges of non-reciprocity. Because there's the assumption, for example, that if Kenya has a visa-free policy or Rwanda has a visa-free policy, that other countries will also reciprocate. So there's a problem if the other countries are not reciprocating in terms of thinking about these visa-free networks across the continent.
Regional blocs have tried this in the past, and it has not quite worked. Even the South African community tried this, and they talked about integration, allowing their people to move across borders. They have been having issues. Do you think this time it will rework?
I think it really depends, because when you talk about the regionalism, regional integration, you know, is a lot better in some contexts, for example, in ECOWAS in West Africa than, for example, within Central Africa. The dynamic is also very much in the detail, right? So if you're thinking with the regional integration, what are the details of access to different constituencies in different countries? So let's take the example of the East African community. Yes, there's common set protocols and there's the understanding of visa-free travel, but there's also a lot of non-tariff barriers around trade, for example, between Kenya and Tanzania. There's still a lot of taxes on tariffs on goods and services from each country against the other. There's domestic constituencies that don't want to see business flowing either one way or the other. We have regional rivalries, of course. Again, Kenya-Tanzania is another good example, or Kenya-Ethiopia, or say between Nigeria and Ghana. We have those regional rivalries. So even though a government signed these protocols, I think the details are really in terms of the detail. To what extent do these programs actually make sense when specifically you're thinking about improving trade? And I talked about this cross-border trade. Or even when we think about the broader issue of the high cost of airline traffic between different African countries. That's another element of this visa-free dynamic, right? How do we reduce the cost of tickets by not having the cost of visas, but also reducing a lot of these bureaucratic hurdles, where some African countries are on board with, for example, the Yamoussoukro Open Skies Accord for Africa, but other countries which want to protect their domestic airlines are not. There's a big gap between the rhetoric of regional integration and the actual practice. And we see that in terms of business, in terms of trade, but also in terms of transfer of skills of professionals between one country and another.
There are some who have said that African countries are trying to copy the European Union model. That would be good, but don't you think it would be better if it had been at the AU level, so that the whole continent is harmonized?
Yes, there's both positives and negatives to that. So if your neighbor has already made a car, you don't need to remake what has already been done. You can just copy what your neighbor has already done and improve on it, right? So I'm thinking of example about the context of, say, Africa and Europe in terms of the EU and the African Union. But I think that there is a valid criticism, particularly in terms of directly copying the European model, from the obvious perspective that the European integration model is very different in terms of context, in terms of history, in terms of bureaucracy from the African context. Our bureaucracies are different. Our histories are different. The formation of states in Europe and Africa is also different. But more importantly, and I think this is something you alluded to, is this question about top-down versus bottom-up. And a lot of the integration in Africa really happens at the heads of summit meetings, where you have very ceremonial, diplomatic protocol around heads of states meeting in Addis Ababa and making these broad declarations around African unity and Pan-Africanism. But really, integration is a lot more than presidents signing agreements at the highest levels.
David Monda is professor of political science at City University of New York. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Impuga from New York. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, the chief executive officer of Ethiopia Airlines says the company plans an expansion to include 7 new routes that forms part of the organization's strategic growth plan. Mesfin Bekele also called on the airline industry to embrace emerging technologies to improve the aviation industry to better serve customers. He cited challenges the industry faces in Africa, which he said needs to be quickly resolved to boost the growth of aviation companies on the continent. Bekele also talked about existing opportunities in Africa. For more on the performance of Ethiopia Airlines and challenges and prospects the airline industry faces in Africa, I reached Mesfin Bekele via Skype. Here is part one of the conversation.
This year has been a very successful year for Ethiopian Airlines. We have expanded our network by increasing frequencies to the existing destinations and adding new destinations. In fact, we opened 7 new destinations in that fiscal year. We have already fully recovered from the impacts of COVID. During the same period, we generated a revenue of $6.1 million, which is about 20% higher than the previous year. So it was a successful year of growth and recovery for Ethiopian Airlines. During the current fiscal year, we have also planned to grow fast taking the same pace that we have been following last year.
So, Mr. Bekele, we had reports about challenges that airlines face at airport hubs. What, looking at the facilities at your partner airport hubs, are you happy with it? And you talked about the growth of expansion for next year. Are they aligned with yours?
Yeah. Following recovery from COVID, we know that most airlines have challenges with airport facilities, readiness of the airports to support their growth plan. And we are not exception to that. Fortunately, we didn't face this problem at most of the destinations where we fly. But unfortunately, we still have challenges at certain airports, like, for example, Heathrow Airport. We used to plan 10 times per week prior to COVID, but now we couldn't go beyond 7 flights per week. We have similar problems in Kenya. We have some slot issues there as well. But by and large, that's not a big problem for us at this time.
So which operational areas do you think the airline industry can improve? And let's delve into the Ethiopian Airlines. Talk to me about improvement that you think can be done within the next few years that could enable the airline industry, particularly in Africa, to significantly improve.
So the industry is growing, but the cost of operation has also grown significantly. One of the challenges the industry faces today is high fuel cost because of the geopolitical instability we see here and there. And the second one, a critical problem for the industry at this time is the supply chain breakdown. We are forced to ground some of our airplanes because of shortage of spare parts. The suppliers are not in a position to fully provide all the parts that we need. These two are major challenges, but the passenger demand is growing, whereas the cargo demand is declining slowly, gradually. And we don't know, you know, the future is unpredictable. Before a month, nobody thought that we would have conflict in the Middle East between Israel and the region. So uncertainty is another problem for the industry. And I believe that the industry has to move cautiously by assessing these environmental conditions.
Mr. Bekele, can we achieve net zero carbon emissions? And what do you think should be done to increase sustainable aviation fuels production? Because you talked about aviation fuels and, you know, how challenging the situation is. So talk to me about zero carbon emissions, if it's achievable.
So every airline is now developing its plan on how to achieve this goal by 2050. There are intermediate targets to be achieved by 2030, by 2035, set by different countries and by different airlines. In that plan, what the industry believes is that if we have to reach zero net carbon emission by 2015, the saving would 67% of the saving would come from use of sustainable aviation fuel, SAF.
Mesfin Bekele is the CEO of Ethiopia Airlines. He spoke with me via Skype from the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. Join us on Sunday for the concluding part of the conversation. In Guinea-Bissau, Parliament is scheduled to open this month, 3 months after new lawmakers were officially sworn in. The 102-member Parliament is expected to begin discussions, including new programs from the government. Local media says there are high expectations for this year's budget, especially since the country has been piling on debt in recent years. Umari Jao is a newly installed member of Parliament from the Madem G15, the second largest opposition party in Guinea-Bissau. I reached him for more about his expectations about the coming session and issues to be addressed in the lawmaking body.
What I'm looking for, when I look at the session agenda, I can tell you that it's very ambitious. There are about 15 items or bills, if you may, on the agenda. Since there are the governing coalition of parties, Pai Terra Ranca has a large majority. The quality of work and depth of discussions will depend on them. What I hope for is to see that we are given a chance to discuss every item with the necessity and quality engagement and responsibility. Look, Peter, I can assure you that Bissau Guineans want to see the country to take off. To do that, we need to send a clear message from the parliament that we are very serious about the issues put before us in this coming session.
The coalition Pai Terra Ranca is expected to present its governing program. Do you think it will pass, looking at what is happening at the moment?
If you do the simple math, you will say yes. Because at the current configuration, Pai Terra Ranca has 54 MPs by itself, plus 12 of PRS, and 6 from PTG, which is the Workers' Party of Guinea-Bissau. So Pai Terra Ranca has a post-electoral agreement with those parties. The voting power at the current situation stands at 72 out of 100 in 2 MPs, which is more than two-thirds required to pay to pass any bills, literally. What I want to see is for them to give a chance to bring all the good policies, all the sound policies to the table so we can lift up people from Guinea-Bissau from poverty.
Guinea-Bissau has been running a deficit for quite some time now, but specifically, what do you want to see in this budget?
What I can tell you is that I am eager to see where the government wants to spend the money, the people's money. Unfortunately, for Guinea-Bissau, Guinea-Bissau is one of the poorest countries in the world and is very dependent also on foreign aid. So we want to see a significant changes in people's lives. So for that to happen, we must be encouraged to do things differently. For instance, we cannot keep putting money in areas that offer no return on the investment. That's basic economic principles. But we also have to be able to challenge the status quo. It is the status quo that put the country in standstill for a very long time, for over 50 years since its independence. So I am hoping that we, as representatives of the people of Guinea-Bissau, we will have the will to stand up for what is best for the entire country, not just specific interest groups or institutions. We have to stand up for the people.
There's talk about constitutional revision or constitutional amendment. Do you think the political climate now in the country is conducive enough for this constitutional amendment or revision?
Probably not. And that's the reason why this issue has come up, which is the constitutional revision, has come up so many, many times. And clearly, Peter, there is a general agreement that the constitution needs to be revised to fully be in compliance with the democratic values we want to inject within the Guinea-Bissau. But, this issue is not an item on the agenda for the November session. Probably probably will come or will be brought back at some point in the future. But at this coming session, it is not in the agenda. Now, for now, there are two items that I would like to bring to your attention that are important to me as an elected official. First, there is a potential to revise the National Electoral Commission, which literally dictates who and how elections are conducted. And second, there's also another bill concerning the voter registration law.
Thank you. Thank you.
Umaru Jao is a newly installed member of the Guinea-Bissau Parliament. He spoke with me from the capital, Bissau. In Zambia, the chairperson of the Anti-Corruption Commission is calling on all public office holders to declare their assets annually. This, Musa Mwinyi says, will help in the fight against graft and mismanagement. Mwinyi, who is a former Zambian Attorney General, also called for mechanisms that will ensure the laws against graft are effectively implemented, irrespective of the individual status in society or political affiliation. For more on what can be done to weed out corruption across Africa and in Zambia, I reach Musa Mwinyi.
Indeed, you cannot fight corruption at all without starting with asset declaration. In fact, declarations of asset, liability and interest are extremely important for fighting corruption. And most progressive countries have gone that way. Everyone from president to lower government officials who handle regulation, licensing, and procurement must declare their assets. That usually is the starting point for lifestyle audits, to see whether leaders are living within their legitimate income that they get. We really can't fight corruption without starting from there. And you, as you know, Peter, even progressive organizations and private entities are doing asset declarations these days.
What do you say to those who are of the thought that even though these laws are on the books, especially in Africa, implementation seems to be found wanting? Because they say that some presidents and senior government officials or, you know, public office holders, although the law compels them to do so, they don't.
Correct. There must be implementation. You can't end at enacting laws that require this declaration of assets, interests, and liabilities alone. You must go beyond that to not only verify the declarations, but insist that leaders do that. In some countries, I know, if I'm not mistaken, Kenya, for example, if you don't declare your assets when you're supposed to, they stop paying you your salary and entitlement. And those are mechanisms that we should increasingly enforce if we want to see the fight against corruption going forward. This continent cannot develop without first fighting corruption. We cannot move forward as a continent without first stopping the leakages of our resources through padding of procurement costs so that people can engage in rent-seeking behavior and also outright theft of public resources.
Musa, there are concerns that even the fight against corruption itself is not holistic enough. They say people or the powers that be use that as a yardstick to go after their perceived political opponents or enemies. And so calling for a lifestyle audit or calling for public office holders to declare their assets might not necessarily even work because they've corrupted the system in every way possible, they say. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, it is true that certain times the corruption fight is used as a bludgeoning weapon to go against political opponents. And the only way you can truly fight corruption is to do it without regard to status or political regalia. But then, Peter, whenever you have declarations of assets, whether it's current government fighting for corruption holistically, the declaration of assets itself, it becomes a deterrent. Because if we allow declarations of assets and make them publicly accessible, the public themselves will be aware of what their politicians do. And, you know, as you are aware, information is power in terms of fighting corruption. Corruption thrives in darkness. If we shine a light in that area, we get more engagement from the public. And then the public themselves can demand accountability from their leaders. So we must do everything we can to engender transparency in public management of public affairs.
Do you think there's a groundswell of support from the population in Zambia that public office holders should declare their assets yearly at least as part of the effort to root out graft in Zambia?
Yes. In fact, in March or April this year, the National Democratic Institute conducted a survey in all the regions of Zambia, and it showed that we have a high support for this. Upwards of 70% of respondents, if I'm not mistaken, support this call, and it goes across regions, across political parties. It's very, very important that we go that way.
Musa Mwenye is the chairperson of the Anti-Corruption Commission. He spoke with me from the Zambian capital, Lusaka. And right now it's time for music from our African collection.
I am mama, I am mama, I am mama aye mama amu bidia ezi nwa malobi mu kakene ezi nwa malobi lelele ezi nwa malobi mbia yiri mu amu bidia abomale shito.
And that was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Douglas Mpuga and engineer Patrick Deya, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, the little opportunity given to a monkey to wear clothes does not guarantee it to join the dining table. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa. Semi,